The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. From the Harvard Health Letter, the importance of bystander CPR. This newer way to perform CPR is easier than the traditional method and it's saving lives. Every year, more than 350,000 Americans experience sudden cardiac arrest when the heart stops beating without any warning. In the agonizing moments before paramedics arrive, there is no blood circulating in the body to deliver oxygen to the brain and other organs. Death is just minutes away. When the cardiac arrest occurs outside of a hospital setting, the survival rate ranges from 2% to 15%, says Dr. K. Ouchi, an emergency physician at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. That grim reality has led to a national call to arms from the American Heart Association to learn a simple, potentially life-saving skill to help someone in cardiac arrest, an abbreviated form of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, known as bystander or hands-only CPR. The American Heart Association says when a bystander promptly performs CPR, it doubles or triples the survival rate. What is bystander CPR? Traditional CPR involves chest compression to manually keep the heart pumping, and also mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to provide oxygen to perform to the person in cardiac arrest. Bystander CPR consists of only the chest compressions. They're both important, says Dr. Ouchi, but when cardiac arrest occurs, there's already some oxygen left in the blood. We've learned it's much more important to pump that blood to the brain and spend the extra seconds or minutes trying to give the patient more oxygen. So now it's compression, compression, compression. How do you do it? Someone in cardiac arrest will collapse, stop breathing, and have no pulse. That's the time to begin by standard CPR. The first step is the most important. Call 911. Once you've reported the emergency, you can begin chest compressions. Dr. Ouchi explains the process this way. Kneel next to the patient's chest. Place the heel of one hand over the other in the middle of the chest. Extend your arms completely. Push down hard at a 90-degree angle. Put your shoulders into it. And after the push, completely release your pressure. That's one compression. Aim for 100 or more compressions per minute. It may help to sing to keep up your pace. A common recommendation is the Bee Gees disco hit Stayin' Alive, which has almost exactly 100 beats per minute. You can get tired very quickly. Switch with someone to get a break, Dr. Ouchi says. Does it work? Chest compressions can help push any remaining oxygenated blood to the organs to keep them alive. Not only can CPR prevent sudden death, the prognosis is good for the person who survives and is discharged from the hospital. The cardiac arrest usually does not leave them with brain damage or other medical problems. Indeed, a 2015 study of more than 4,000 people in Denmark, published May 12, 2015 in Circulation, found that more than 75% of people who survived a cardiac arrest that occurred outside a hospital were able to return to work in about 4 months. Those who received CPR from a bystander were nearly 40% more likely to go back to work compared to survivors who didn't get CPR. Dr. Ouchi says that when CPR is accompanied by the use of an automated external defibrillator, or an AED, which uses electricity in an attempt to restart the heart, there is an even better chance for survival. AEDs are used only for certain kinds of irregular heartbeats. Where can you learn it? The AHA, the American Heart Association, American Red Cross, YMCAs, and even some local hospitals offer classes in bystander CPR. They may or may not be free. You can also watch this video that demonstrates the life-saving skill. It's located at www.heart.org/hands-only-CPR. The pros and cons of root vegetables. They're packed with nutrients but high in starchy carbs. Root vegetables like turnips, rutabagas, and parsnips may not be the sexiest foods on the table, but they're big celebrities in a number of cuisine trends like the vegetable forward movement, which elevates vegetables into creative entrees and side dishes, and root-to-stem cooking, which uses every part of a vegetable, including the tops, stems, and skins. While it's fun to use old standbys in more interesting ways, like roasted parsnips with pistachio and lemon, it's important to eat root vegetables judiciously. They are so high in carbohydrates that they are more like grains than greens. It makes more sense to put them in the same category as breads, rice, or pasta, says dietitian Teresa Fung, adjunct professor in the nutrition department at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. What are root vegetables? Root vegetables grow underground at the base of a plant. Technically, they're not all roots. Some are bulbous growths that store nutrients to feed the plants in colder months. Examples include bulbs like fennel, onions, corms, C-O-R-M-S, like celery root, water chestnut, rhizomes, R-H-I-Z-O-M-E-S, like ginger or turmeric, tap roots like beets, carrots, parsnips, tuberous roots like sweet potatoes and yucca, and tubers, potatoes and yams. The bulbs, roots, and tubers absorb water and nutrients to feed the rest of the plant. Those nutrients make them dietary powerhouses for us. The pros of root vegetables. Root vegetables are low in calories and high in antioxidants. Each one contains a wide variety of vitamins and minerals. Some have nutrients in surprisingly high amounts. For example, the flesh of a medium-baked sweet potato has only 103 calories and enough vitamin A, 1,096 micrograms, to meet your entire recommended dietary allowance for the day. For adults 51 or older, that's 700, and for women, 900. Carrots are also a good source of vitamin A, with 1,069 micrograms in a cup of chopped raw carrots. A cup of mashed turnips has 51 calories and 76 milligrams of calcium, as much calcium as half a slice of cheddar cheese. A medium-baked russet potato, including its skin, has 164 calories and 935 milligrams of potassium, more than twice the potassium of a medium-sized banana. The cons of root vegetables. Most root vegetables are also starches, a kind of carbohydrate that the body breaks down into glucose for energy. For example, there are 37 grams of carbs in a baked russet potato and 24 grams in a medium-baked sweet potato. Fung warns that if you eat more carbs than your body needs, it will store them as fat, leading to weight gain. Eating too many carbs in one sitting can spike your blood sugar. Frequent spikes of blood sugar can increase the chance of developing diabetes and makes it more difficult to manage diabetes if you already have it. Still, some root vegetables have fewer carbs than others. For example, a cup of chopped raw carrots has only 12 grams of carbs. A large cooked onion has only 13. Another potential problem, how do you prepare root vegetables? When you eat mashed potatoes, you're probably adding butter and other unhealthy ingredients. Or maybe you top a baked potato with sour cream and bacon bits, and it's quite easy to overeat and end up eating a lot of calories that aren't so satiating, Fung says. What you should do. Root vegetables are still fresh whole foods that contain many vitamins and minerals. Eating a variety of them is good for your health. Fung says that if you're healthy, you can probably eat one serving of root vegetables every day. Just make sure it's a side dish or part of another dish, and it's the only starch on your plate, she advises. In other words, don't have a serving of rice and a serving of sweet potatoes. And don't eat the same root vegetable all the time. Eat a variety of them to get a wider selection of nutrients. Try turnips, yucca, which is cassava, Jerusalem artichoke, yams, beets, or radishes. If you're looking for easy ways to eat root vegetables, try them boiled, mashed, baked, roasted, with a little olive oil, or tossed in soups and casseroles. Alternately, you can follow a food trend and get creative with root vegetables. The secret is using atypical cooking methods such as braising, barbecuing, or searing, and then pairing the vegetable with interesting flavors. Considered barbecued carrots with yogurt and pecans, miso glazed tunips, or Jerusalem artichoke with shallots and toasted hazelnuts. With a little imagination, you may soon find root vegetables a lot more interesting. Are drugstore sleep aids safe? Observe these caveats if you use over-the-counter drugs or dietary supplements to help you sleep. It's 2 a.m. and you can't sleep. Is it okay to take a non-prescription remedy? They're not meant for the long term, but it may be okay for an occasional night of problems with sleep, says sleep expert Dr. Lawrence Epstein, an instructor in medicine at the Harvard Medical School. But which option should you reach for? Drugstore shelves are lined with a dizzying array of products promising a good night's sleep. They fall under two categories, non-prescription medications and dietary supplements. Non-prescription medications. Sleep medications that are available over-the-counter use antihistamines as their main active ingredient. Nitol, Somanex, and Unisom, the blue capsule form, for example, contain 25 to 50 milligrams of the antihistamine diphenhydramine per pill. Other over-the-counter sleep medications, such as Unisom sleep tabs, contain 25 milligrams per pill of an antihistamine called doxylamine succinate. These medications work by blocking certain brain chemicals, which can have a sedating effect. They are generally safe, but come with some risks. You tend to become tolerant of the effect relatively quickly, so they stop working for you. And we don't have a lot of long-term data about what happens if you use them for long periods of time, Dr. Epstein says. And there is the potential that antihistamines may cause side effects in older adults, such as confusion and falls. Another risk, some over-the-counter sleep aids contain other medications. For example, Tylenol PM contains not only 25 milligrams of diphenhydramine, but also 500 milligrams of acetaminophen, a pain reliever. You might not be aware of that if you're focused only on the sleep benefits of a medication. Dietary supplements. Many kinds of supplements claim to help you sleep. For example, valerian, V-A-L-E-R-I-A-N, valerian root. The root of this tall flowering plant is said to help people fall asleep and to quell anxiety and stress. It has been used as a medicinal herb since the days of ancient Rome. Chamomile. Use of this flower, which looks like a daisy, also goes back thousands of years. It's taken in pills as well as teas. Many people drink a cup of chamomile tea at bedtime. It is considered mild and safe to help you become drowsy, but some people have an allergic reaction to chamomile, especially those who are allergic to ragweed. Melatonin. This supplement comes from a lab, not a plant. It's a synthetic version of the human hormone that helps regulate your sleep-wake cycle. But Dr. Epstein says it's not a sleep medication. It makes people a little sleepy, but it has a much greater effect in shifting the timing of the sleep phase, he explains. Dr. Epstein advises taking 1 to 3 milligrams of melatonin 2 to 3 hours before bedtime. If you're trying to better align your sleep cycle because of jet lag or a night shift job, he says you can take the melatonin safely for the long term. A word about prescription sleep aids. Prescription sleep medications are powerful drugs that work on different parts of the brain. Benzodiazepines like lorazepam, which is Ativan, and temazepam or Restoril target gamma aminobutyric acid, GABA, a brain chemical that reduces nerve activity and promotes sleep. These medications can be habit-forming, may cause daytime sleepiness, and may be associated with dementia. Non-benzodiazepines, such as Zolpidem, which is Ambien, and Fizione or Lunesta also work on GABA, but they leave the body faster and have fewer side effects, allowing for regular walking and daytime functioning the next day. However, they still increase the risk for sleepwalking and daytime sleepiness, which can lead to falls and injuries. And then finally, melatonin receptor agonists such as Remeltion or Rozerim, R-O-Z-E-R-E-M, target melatonin receptors in the brain. They leave the body quickly and are not thought to be habit-forming. These medications are meant for short-term use only under the direction of your doctor. They're most helpful for the treatment of insomnia, but medications are just one option to treat insomnia. Behavioral therapy, which involves looking at your sleep habits and ways you think about sleep and routines, is equally effective, says sleep expert Dr. Epstein. A word of caution. Even though supplements are widely taken to help people sleep, we don't actually know if they work. There are essentially no data on any of the herbal supplements that show effectiveness, except for a minor beneficial effect of valerian root, Dr. Epstein says. Many supplements can have minor side effects, such as headache, dizziness, or nausea, or they may increase the effect of alcohol or other drugs you're taking, such as another sleep medication. Perhaps the biggest concern is that the FDA doesn't regulate supplements, and so there's no way to know if a pill contains what a manufacturer says it does. What should you do if you want to take an over-the-counter sleep drug or a dietary supplement? Speak with your doctor or pharmacist first to make sure it won't interact with any medications you're taking. If you're having more than an occasional night of sleepiness, it may be time to figure out what's really causing the trouble. Most sleep problems can be corrected without medication, Dr. Epstein says, but it may take many approaches. Sleep problems are often caused by many things, not just one thing that can be fixed with a pill. Special report, stroke. This is from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Seconds count when the brain loses blood supply. You may know someone who had a stroke and was never the same again, or the opposite, perhaps a friend who had a stroke but after a lot of hard work is able to live a fairly normal life. That's one thing about strokes. They occur in different ways and people have different outcomes. Your best strategy is knowing what causes a stroke so you can adjust some lifestyle factors and lower your risk. It's also smart to know how to recognize the signs and symptoms of a stroke and to get help quickly if you find yourself or someone you know having a stroke. Doctors have a saying about stroke care. Time is brain. Getting immediate medical care can make a big difference when it comes to surviving a stroke and lowering the risk of debilitating complications. It also speeds your path to rehabilitation and recovery, which is a crucial piece of successful stroke care. A stroke occurs when the blood supply to part of the brain is suddenly altered. Brain tissue may be deprived of oxygen or nutrients or drowned in blood. This can cause brain cells to quickly die or become severely damaged, resulting in temporary or permanent changes to your brain function and body. The signs and symptoms of a stroke, which can include trouble walking, speaking, seeing, understanding others, or moving one side of your body, appear suddenly. They may be permanent or, in some cases, last a short time and disappear. For effective and safe treatment, doctors must quickly determine what's causing your stroke. Types of stroke. There are two main types of stroke, ischemic and hemorrhagic. Almost 90% of strokes are ischemic strokes. They take place when the arteries to the brain are narrowed or blocked, causing severely reduced blood flow, which deprives brain cells of oxygen and nutrients. That's ischemia. If this continues even for a few minutes, brain cells start to die. The most common ischemic strokes are thrombotic stroke. This occurs when a blood clot, a thrombus, forms in one of the arteries that supplies blood to your brain. A clot usually forms in areas damaged by arteriosclerosis, a disease which the arteries are hardened and clogged by fatty deposits or plaque. This process often occurs within one or both of the carotid arteries of your neck, but also can occur in other arteries in your neck and brain. Embolic stroke. This occurs when a blood clot or other material forms away from your brain in an artery, in the heart or some other site, and is swept through your bloodstream and into the brain artery. This type of material, called an embolus, commonly forms in your heart. It's often caused by an irregular beating of the heart's upper chambers or atrial fibrillation. This abnormal rhythm can lead to uncoordinated heart contractions, pooling of blood in the heart chambers, and formation of blood clots that then travel elsewhere. A transient ischemic attack, or TIA, sometimes called a mini stroke, isn't technically a stroke. Most signs and symptoms of a transient ischemic attack disappear within an hour. Its signs and symptoms last longer than 24 hours or cause lasting brain damage. It's considered a stroke. A TIA is similar to ischemic stroke because it most frequently occurs when a clot or other material, such as a small plaque, blocks blood flow to part of the brain. This blockage is temporary and doesn't leave lasting effects. However, if you have a TIA, you're at a greater risk of future ischemic stroke that could cause permanent damage. Hemorrhagic strokes are less common than ischemic strokes. However, these strokes, which occur when a blood vessel in the brain leaks or ruptures, are very serious. The two main categories of hemorrhagic strokes are intracerebral hemorrhage. This occurs when a blood vessel in the brain bursts and blood spills into the surrounding brain tissue, damaging cells. Brain cells beyond the leak can also be deprived of blood and become damaged. High blood pressure or hypertension is the most common cause of this form of hemorrhagic stroke. Subarachnoid hemorrhage. In this type of stroke, bleeding starts in an artery of the brain and spills into the spaces between your brain and the lining covering the brain, called the arachnoid. This type of hemorrhage is commonly caused by the rupture of an aneurysm, which is a small sac or bubble that forms off a weak spot in the blood vessel. This is called an aneurysm. After the hemorrhage, one of the early complications occurs when the blood vessels in your brain widen and narrow erratically, and that's vasospasm, causing brain cell damage by further limiting blood flow to parts of your brain. Who's at risk? Many stroke risk factors are related to how you live and can be reduced, modified through behavior. Risk factors include hypertension. Higher than normal blood pressure is considered the most potent risk factors for strokes. It can weaken and damage blood vessels in and around your brain, leaving them vulnerable to hemorrhage and artery clogging, atherosclerosis. Exercising regularly, losing excess weight, and eating a diet low in fat and sodium and rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat dairy products can help lower blood pressure and keep it in check. Medications such as diuretics, calcium channel blockers, and angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE inhibitors, may be recommended to keep hypertension under control. Cholesterol. High levels of bad low-density lipoprotein, or LDL cholesterol, and triglycerides, which are another blood fat, can cause a buildup of plaque on artery walls. High levels of a good form of cholesterol, known as high-density lipoprotein, HDL, can protect against strokes, probably by helping to remove excess cholesterol from the blood. The same lifestyle changes that can lower high blood pressure can improve cholesterol levels. If your cholesterol levels still remain at an undesirable level, your doctor may recommend drugs in the statin class or other medications to lower the levels of the bad cholesterol in your blood. Smoking. Smokers' risk of strokes may be 2 to 4 times greater than non-smokers' risk. Smoking promotes atherosclerosis, makes your blood thicker and more likely to clot, and can contribute to aneurysm formation. Stopping smoking at any age can reduce the risk of stroke and other risk factors associated with strokes, including hypertension and heart disease. If you smoke and you're interested in quitting, talk to your doctor. There are a number of programs and medications that can improve your chances of stopping. Diabetes. This condition triples your risk of strokes. Besides affecting your body's ability to use sugar or glucose, diabetes can also cause destructive changes in blood vessels, including blood vessels in your brain. Diabetes usually can be managed effectively with diet, exercise, and medication. Heart disease. Common heart disorders such as atrial fibrillation, coronary artery disease leading to a heart attack, valve defects, and enlargement of one of the heart's chambers can result in blood clots that may break loose and block vessels within or leading to the brain. If you have one of these disorders, work with your doctor to manage it and prevent complications. Obstructive sleep apnea. With this condition, your throat muscles intermittently relax and block your airway during sleep, causing your breathing to temporarily stop before restarting. This can cause sudden drops in your blood oxygen levels. Sleep apnea can also increase blood pressure and may increase the occurrence of irregular heartbeats, such as atrial fibrillation. Eventually, this can raise stroke risk. Losing weight, drinking alcohol in moderation, or not at all, not smoking, and not sleeping on your back can improve mild cases of obstructive sleep apnea. For moderate to severe cases, your doctor may recommend treatments such as a continuous positive airway pressure CPAP device to keep your upper airway passages open during sleep. Obesity. If you carry excess weight, you increase your risk for developing conditions that increase your stroke risk, including hypertension, high cholesterol, heart disease, and diabetes. Losing weight, even just 10 pounds, may help lower your blood pressure and improve your cholesterol levels. Inactivity. If you've been largely inactive, try gradually working up to 30 minutes of activity, such as walking, swimming, or bicycling, or on most, if not all, days of the week. Talk to your doctor about what type and level of activity may be best for you. Heavy alcohol use. Drinking to excess can lead to an increase in blood pressure, raising your risk of both ischemic and hemorrhagic strokes. However, moderate drinking for healthy adults, up to one drink a day for women of all ages and men older than 65, and up to two drinks a day for men age 65 and younger, is generally considered safe in terms of cardiovascular risk. It may even offer some stroke protection by increasing good HDL cholesterol and decreasing your blood's clotting tendency. Still, if you don't already drink or have stopped drinking, don't start. Previous stroke or TIA. If you've already had a TIA or stroke, your risk of a future stroke is significantly increased. Still, lifestyle changes, medications, and sometimes a surgical procedure can help with prevention. Other risk factors can't be changed but should be recognized, which include a family history, age, sex, and race. The risk of strokes among different ethnic and racial groups, black people are at highest risk. We will continue this discussion of strokes on the next visit, because we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.